But I'm really pleased. I can't tell you how pleased I am to have this event here at Telesea and to have the platform that we have and to have what is, congratulations to you all, a very, very good turnout at exam time. So we're very pleased. And we think the subject deserves the turnout because not only do we have it, which is in itself important, how free is free speech, but we have three people who are really able to comment on it from different perspectives in a way which will add greatly to our understanding. Those of you who are in my class will know that the LL475 terrorism class, I hasten to add the study off from a sociological, not practical perspective, for those of you who are not in the class, and these days saying terrorism class without further explanation might cause me to be prosecuted, will follow immediately after this in this room. We're going to reflect on this paradox at the core of liberal society, which appears to be that we are so determined that we believe in free speech that we will deny your right to disclaim it. So there's a kind of sense in which speech is controlled for the sake of speech. I could go on at some length and won't about how this has been a commonplace in 20th century democracy and not as new as some of us might believe, but whether new or old is something to notice in our culture. We're going to start with Peter O'Byrne. I'm delighted to call a friend, and he's been working with The Spectator. We didn't put in formally of the Daily Mail because at LSE the words Daily Mail are removed from all computer printouts automatically. We are, of course, part of the liberal elite. He used to, I think, were allowed reported orally, work for the Daily Mail, and most recently has worked at the Daily Telegraph and has frontline experience of what it's like to challenge assumptions about the marketing of newspapers where advertisers determine not just their own copy but the copy of the paper to which they contribute. So I'll be very interested to hear Peter. I think I said number two was Eulalie Burnham. Eulalie is a barrister at Doughty Street Chambers, specialising in mental health law, I think, Eulalie, isn't that right, and a bit of the human rights stuff, and we're very grateful to her for stepping in, because some of you may have seen when you registered that we had Philippa Kaufman, and Philippa couldn't come because she had to go to something to do with her personal circumstances, and she's fine and everything, but she couldn't come, and we're really grateful for Eulalie stepping in at short notice. I've known our third speaker for a number of years now, Dr. Abdul Wahid, who is the chair of Hizb ut-Tahrir here in UK, and he will, of course, speak about the impact of qualified commitments to free speech where you're involved in an organisation which has, on occasion, drawn some critical comments from no less a figure than the Prime Minister, not to mention other political leaders. And it's not impossible, Abdul, that were the Home Secretary had to have her way after the election with the proposition that there should be some prevention orders, this might be one of the last occasions where you can lawfully present in a public forum. I don't know, I don't anticipate, and that's jumping a number of hurdles ahead, but it is an exceptional pleasure for me to be able to invite Abdul to the event. The way we're going to do it is we're going to hand over to Peter. Peter's going to speak for, he says, 10 minutes. I've got an eye on the clock. I am, as some of you know, a pretty tough chair, and so I'll be beginning to fidget at 10 minutes and would be downright rude at 10 minutes and 35 seconds. We have Eulalie, who's going to speak for the same length of time, and we have Abdul, who has said he wants a more contextual approach to the definition of 10 minutes, and I've resisted that, and 10 minutes remains 10 minutes and 35 seconds. My commitment to free speech does have boundaries. And then the point of this is to get up and running with a question and answer session, comments, observations, and so on, and we'll be finished before 2:30. So those of you who are making plans for the afternoon, you will be able to leave here without being rude about 25 minutes past 2:00. Peter, here maybe, there, but starting perhaps at the rostrum and then taking the cues later from the table, over to you. Let's give him a round of applause, people.
Thank you very much indeed, Professor Getty. It's great pleasure to be at the LSE, a great where free speech is normally accepted. I think this is one of the most important issues of our time. It's particularly important in the wake of the atrocity in Paris, perhaps a few months ago, the Charlie Hebdo horror. But it's also, it's helped the issue of what is free speech and how it can be addressed is one which is starting to dominate a whole load of areas of public life. And I'd like to start off by observing that free speech is a bit like, is very related to, but it's also a bit like democracy. Democracy of and of itself is not a very good thing. In many ways, it's a very dangerous thing. Hitler was elected democratically as Chancellor of Germany. It's always an important thing to remember that. What we have in Britain is representative democracy. That is to say, the popular will is mitigated by undemocratic institutions. The most important of those institutions is the rule of law, the judges, but there are other institutions. There's the press, which is undemocratic, it tends to be owned by very rich private individuals based offshore. Then we have the House of Lords. I'm a great believer in the House of Lords. It has I'm glad to say, an hereditary element. That is important because it means that the decisions made by democratically elected politicians can be moderated by people who are not democratically elected, not accountable to voters. Democracy works only because, and this is something which also the founders of the American Constitution understood, if it's got very strong undemocratic elements. The same applies to free speech. I've read an awful lot in the commentary on Charlie Hebdo. There was a lot of people saying that there is an unmitigated right to free speech. It's never been the case in this country or any other that I know of. In Britain, there's always been huge constraints on free speech. In the earlier centuries, these tended to relate to religion and sex. We had the great Chatterley trial in the early 60s when I think the right was to have what would now be called pornography. A bit of sexual material in a published novel was challenged in High Court. And you couldn't insult religions, the church. Now it's sort of changed. The restraints on free speech, you can, according to British law, say what you like about sex, more or less. There are less restraints on some religious commentary. The free speech is now concerned with race. The restraints on free speech are concerned with race, to some extent, and not stirring up religious hatred, but mainly racial hatred, other sensibilities. These are the restraints, and I welcome these restraints. I think they're very important. Because we have, as writers, I don't really welcome all of these restraints, but I do think as writers we're part of a civilized, part of civil society. And so the fact that there are laws against racial hatred, stirring up racial hatred, promoting violence and so forth, are very good laws, I think. And so, in other words, there is no such thing as an undiluted right to free speech. All sorts of things we can't say. We can't deny the Holocaust. That's good. Denying the Holocaust is a form of anti-Semitism. No, we can't use certain prejudicial words against people of ethnic minorities. That's very good. And we used to be able to do that. Agatha Christie wrote a novel, very middle-brow English novel. It's called Ten Little Niggers in the 30s. That's not acceptable. Now, so the claim made after Charlie Hebdo that there is something called free speech is false. Unmitigated. There is something, we all make enormous accommodations. And so what is interesting is the way in which we structure our constraints and live with our constraints on free speech. And I think it's worth noting, I certainly notice there are certain paradoxes here, that you can make any assertions what you like under British law, as far as I can see, about Islam. I think this is a problem, that you can make, you can insult Islam in whatever way you like legally, in a way you can't insult Jews. Jews are, because anti-Semitism is an ethnic matter. I think I'm right in saying you're insulting people on racial grounds, whereas Islam, you're insulting a religion. And I made a study for Channel 4 a few years ago with the way what this meant. You can basically accuse Muslims of what you like, you know, of closing down Christmas, of sort of being an impediment to public life. You can just say Muslims mainly. You can make any generalization you wish. And I think this is a... This has become a sort of proxy way of attacking a section of society. The question of Charlie Hebdo is very interesting. Were they exercising free speech or were they attacking a minority? Were they just using license of free speech to victimize and attack a minority? And I think that's a discussion which goes to the heart of what we sort of society we want to be. My view, and I haven't made a full study of every issue of Charlie Hebdo, is that there was a major racist element in those cartoonists and those writers on Charlie Hebdo. It's not to excuse in any way whatever, by the way, this barbarous act in Paris. It's just simply to make an observation there that there is a problem about... we need to understand what we're talking about when we're talking about free speech. Is it just simply a freedom to pillory and victimise a minority? In the light of all that, it's interesting how... the recent events in free speech, we had the attempts to reframe public discourse about terrorism. Words such as extremists and radical have suddenly entered the language, and we the recent under the coalition government, terrorism has been widened to include language. All kinds of. How many more minutes have I got? You were very severe, Professor.
Comma, if any. Right. One and a half. I'll extend it to two.
No. Thank you very much.
We can't get it to half.
I haven't got to really. Yeah. I was. It's not quite time enough to deal with this very interesting area, which is the ways in which, far from fostering free speech, there's been a new categories of banned speech have been introduced in recent anti-terrorism legislation. In fact, the whole definition of terrorism has been widened from learned barristers next to me know more than this, but widened way beyond sort of committing violent acts to writing, sort of having opinions. And so the other day down in Southampton, the university wanted to have a debate about the state of Israel, and whether and there were quite a balanced lot of people there. It was stopped. Well, I think we need to ask, therefore, there's a new set of rules about what is free speech and what can be said publicly. And I don't think any of us really understand, this is my final point, exactly what these rules are anymore. Because we're not, and I think that the first thing we need to get out of our head is that there is an untrammeled right to free speech that isn't. And so we need to ask ourselves another question, is what are the rules which should determine what things we can say and what we can't in public? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. There will, of course, be lots of time to talk so we can develop those themes, Peter, to sort of start. I'm reminding the stewards that after Ulele, Abdul has a PowerPoint, so we need... It's all ready? Good. Ulele, thank you. 10 minutes.
Good afternoon, everyone. Conor, thank you very much for inviting me. Just remind people that I'm not Philippa Kaufman, which means that you should blame her for me being here, but don't blame her for anything I say. I'm neither an extremism nor terrorism or free speech expert. I'm an equality lawyer and a mental health lawyer, and I've had some dealings with offshoots of what the counter-terrorism strategy in this country and what impact it's had on people in equality terms. What I'm going to do this afternoon, if I can, given Connor's guillotine, is to actually do three small things, I hope. First of all, to tell you a little bit about the legal context of Article 10 of the European Convention on Human Rights and how it works. Then to look very briefly at how it may or may not have been applied domestically, and to look at what dangers we have now in the context of the way in which the state has been responding to developments within different communities which involve things like the Birmingham Trojan Horse letter and the so-called Islamicization of various communities and schools. So that's the three broad things I'm going to look at, and I'm going to try and deal with them briefly, and we can take up questions and answers later on. Now, since this is a discussion about free speech, I think I should be provocative. And what I want to say is that it's right, as Peter said a few moments ago, and I think Conor is more au fait with this than I am, but the definitions of terrorism that we operate with in the legal context now include things like glorifying terrorism and dissemination of information, etc. But I think rather what we should look at when we're talking about terrorism is to look sometimes, at least historically, and one of the definitions of terrorism I found most helpful is one by academics called Zuleika and William Douglas, where what is said is this: characteristically, terrorism discourse singles out and removes from the larger historical and political context a psychological trait, open quotes, terror, an organizational structure, open quotes, the terrorist network, and a category, terrorism, open close quotes, in order to invent an autonomous and aberrant realm of gratuitous evil that defies any understanding. That is something I think a number of us would be very familiar with in the way terrorism is talked about and the discourses we have about it. But anyway, what does that have to do with free speech, and what am I talking about? To some extent, I agree with what Peter said earlier, which is that free speech has never really been free, and one of the great proponents of or writers about free speech, Stanley Fish, once said that free speech is what is left over when a community has determined in advance what it does not want to hear. And I think this is correct, and everything we see today indicates that that is correct, including the Charlie Hebdo incident. And again, I'll issue a series of disclaimers. I'm not suggesting in any way that murder, homicide, acts of violence are justified because of offence created by artistic or other expression. Anyway, so what does Article 10 of the European Convention say? It says that essentially the first bit of it, the first part of it protects free speech and freedom of expression. The second part of it allows that expression to be qualified in a number of prescribed circumstances. And those circumstances can include national security, territorial integrity, public safety, prevention of disorder or crime, and so on. So the state can interfere with that right in the interests of those legitimate aims. It The right to free speech in the convention covers not merely information, but ideas, popular ideas and unpopular ideas, and also protects persons who say offensive things, shocking things, and disturbing things. Now, when these, if in fact the speech shocks or offends or goes beyond the boundaries of legal regulation or what is permitted, there are a number of steps that the state can take to protect those who, for example, might be vulnerable to it or victims of it, if it tips over into harassment or incitement to racial hatred, etc., etc. And that those the kinds of laws that protect those who are vulnerable to the impact of certain kinds of speech would be, there are injunctions to prevent incitement for racial hatred. There's the law of libel and defamation, including the misuse of private law relating to the misuse of confidential or private information. There is the Protection from Harassment Act. There is, of course, equality law, because in lots of ways, some of what we see pass as free speech may be racially, in gender terms, in religious terms, etc., inflammatory and an incitement to hatred of that particular group. And there are, of course, criminal sanctions which accompany those civil offences. Now, the way that the convention looks at free speech, I just wanted to say two real major things about the convention. And one of the things that is noticeable is that the convention does have, in my view, Judeo-Christian bias in the way it approaches issues of free speech. Many of you here probably, I'm assuming you're in Connors class, so you know a lot. The Otto Preminger case in 1994 was one where there was a depiction, a satirical depiction of God and Christ and the Virgin Mary, and the court in 1994 found that was too offensive, and therefore it was okay to interfere with those who had authored it or put it around. And the question I would ask, and I'm putting this out for discussion, is what would be the response be if, for example, if the court was to look at the issue of the Danish cartoonist some years ago? What would the response be? Would it be, as it were, in Preminger? Will we see that kind of response? Because when we look at how the court, for example, looks at issues like the wearing of the hijab, we see that the court adopts a more secularist approach to that kind of thing. But when we look at the way it approaches, if you like, freedom of expression in the context of Christianity, it in 94, it may be different now, but in 94 what it did was in fact to say that the outrage was in fact too much. Also in 2008, in the case of Leroy in France, there was a young French man, I believe, who drew a cartoon which was thought to be condoning 9/11 and the terrorist violence. His conviction was upheld. He only received a small fine for this, but his conviction was upheld. And what the court said in that instance was that notwithstanding the fact that his cartoon was intended to be a criticism more generally or more widely of American imperialism, the fact is the timing of it, so soon after 9/11, and of course so soon after, or so in such close proximity to the bombings here and elsewhere in the continent, the conviction should be upheld and was not an interference with his free speech rights. So the question one has to ask is how does the universalism of the convention affect the protection of various minorities and their free speech rights? Because one of the debates that seems to me is quite interesting is what when you look at the issue of, and Peter alluded to Charlie Hebdo and so on, when you look at that issue of the way in which many believers in Islam treat depictions of the Prophet, ought we to look at the cartoons which do depict the Prophet in quite the same way as we might treat those of us who come from Judeo-Christian societies, and I certainly do, the way we would treat criticisms of Christ or satirical representations of Christ? Is it the same thing? Should we be balancing it differently? And that may be the legal and the sociological and political question. Right, so when... Conor, how am I doing?
Moving on, I think. Yeah, I don't want to cut you short.
Okay.
But we want to... Yeah, three or four...
Okay,
minutes.
Lovely. Yeah. Right. So that's the context in which discussions of free speech might or might not occur. And one of the things that worries me is the approach that we seem to be taking in this jurisdiction to a lot of to the upshot of what seems to be some extremist violence in response to free expression. And one of the interesting things to note, for example, here was the, as I alluded to earlier, the report prepared by Peter Clark on the Birmingham Trojan Horse letter. I don't know how many of you know about the Birmingham Trojan Horse letter, but that was a letter in which what happened. It was written in 2013, and it appeared to demonstrate a strategy among certain Muslim members of various teaching communities and so on to take over Birmingham schools. An investigation then ensued, and Mr. Clark wrote a report on it. And he made a variety of recommendations about this. And he said that there was obviously an indication that there was an attempt to do so, which involved bullying some head teachers, pushing people out, and an attempt to what he described as Islamicize the school, a number of schools in Birmingham. So he made a series of recommendations, which I haven't got time to go into, but you can find those online if you look for the July 2014 report. In consequence of his recommendations, the government issued something called the Misconduct of Teachers Guidance. And in that guidance, what it introduced was a new category of misconduct for which teachers can be penalized, and that's described as follows: actions or behaviors that undermine fundamental British values of democracy, the rule of law, individual liberty and mutual respect and tolerance of those with different faiths and beliefs, or that promote political or religious extremism. You see, these are sort of very fluid and contested concepts which are being introduced into something that has legal and material effect. This would encompass deliberately allowing the exposure of pupils to such actions or behaviours, including through contact with any individuals who are widely known to express views that support such activity, for example, by inviting any such individuals to speak in schools. Now, there are a number of cases I'm aware of on the go in relation to teachers who have been penalised by reference to these kinds of frameworks. And it'd be interesting to see how they play out in the courts, because it seems to me that when we go back and we think about the convention case law on incitement to terrorism and things like that, when we look at this context, when we look at the context of what's happening in schools, it seems to me what is required for those who want to punish teachers by way of dismissal or serious disciplinary sanction, we've got to get a little bit more concrete than these kinds of definitions of promoting fundamental British values of democracy. One of those values might be indeed free speech and the freedom to share ideas. But when we're in the domain of educating young minds, that actually introduces something much more complex about what it is that teachers are allowed to impart. But my worry is that the current approach adopted by the government is one which is infused with a certain kind of moral panic. And I'm concerned about what that does to the jurisprudence on free speech and the very notion of free speech, which should be protected but mustn't be protected by crushing it, in my view. I think that's probably all I've got time for.
Thank you. Thank you.
We're anarchy induced upon the world. There's been two speakers who've taken 11 and 35 seconds and 12 minutes. So I think I'm going to give you your 12 minutes. There's going to be a PowerPoint, so I'm going to walk down there so I can look at this. Later on, but Dr. White.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Connor, thank you so much for inviting me. I don't get invited to universities very much these days. But it's nice to be able to radicalise people on campus after such a long time. Operating the PowerPoint. Just press the shift key.
Just the next slide.
The next slide, okay. I'm going to focus on what was in the advertisement for this talk. The question was asked, what is an extremist, and how can a society that says it's committed to upholding freedom seek to stop political speech it disagrees with? Well, what is an extremist? I can tell you now, the Home Office funds a whole bunch of organisations up and down the UK that you can pay to go and learn about extremism and what is an extremist. One of the organisations, who will remain nameless, run an ideology training course. This is a real magazine, a real brochure that goes with the course that they teach. You can get CPD points for it as well. This is the cover. Leaves you in no doubt about the nature of the subject matter. Bin Laden, Anders Breivik, Carlos the Jackal, even Adolf Hitler. But you have to get to page 8 to get onto me. Okay. Now, I'm fairly thick-skinned. I'm with an organisation that is considered radical. I'm with an organisation that speaks out very publicly. Definitely, we cut across the thrust of what are secular liberal values and our beliefs. We're a non-violent organisation everywhere we exist across the world. I'm fairly thick-skinned. It took two people to bring this to my attention before I spoke to a very good lawyer who wrote them a shirty letter to have me removed from that. But I think if there's one message I want to get across to people today, it is that although organisations like Hizb ut-Tahrir or the Muslim Brotherhood or many Islamic groups are demonised in the media, although many of them have police visiting venues to put pressure on venue owners to withhold them from speaking, although many of them are prevented from speaking in universities on the grounds of health and safety or not being able to secure a venue, most of the people that are affected by the government's counter-extremism policies are ordinary Muslims, not people like me that go out there and speak. They are ordinary Muslims. And here's proof of that. I have several examples. I've been going around the country the last few weeks telling people in the Muslim community how bad Prevent, the government's counter-extremism strategy, is. And I've had several stories come to my attention about how bad it really is, and I'm going to bring them up. But then this very bad slide, I'm afraid, appeared on social media, and the guy who's the subject of this contacted our website. He's a young man who lives in Derbyshire, who he and his wife have been trying to adopt, and they went through the rigours of the adoption process, and part of that is a criminal record search, a CRB check, an enhanced CRB check. And the result of the CRB check was that Derbyshire Constabulary said that this man is believed to hold radical and extreme views, and on those grounds, they should not be allowed to adopt. The details of this are as follows. The man shared two articles from Hizb ut-Tahrir's website online on his social media page. One of the articles was an article we wrote saying that the prosecution against the former Guantanamo detainee, Muazzam Beg, which collapsed last year because there was no evidence that he'd done anything of a terrorist nature, was politically motivated. On the grounds of that, Derbyshire police are saying this guy has promoted two articles from Hizb ut-Tahrir. Hizb ut-Tahrir believes in Islam and Sharia. A child brought up in a house where anyone could support Hizb ut-Tahrir and Sharia is basically in danger, and therefore this guy should not be allowed to adopt. I can tell you in Denmark, social services take children away from families on the grounds that those families are too Islamic. The other stories I've come across include two school children in secondary school, one who at the height of the Gaza attacks last year shared a statement which was in solidarity with the people of Gaza and accusing the Israelis of being murderers of children. That was enough to get him reported to a head teacher as an extremist. And one school teacher, one child in a secondary school in London, who I've heard from his lawyer, because of his own religious beliefs, doesn't want to play a musical instrument. And on those grounds, he's been referred to Channel. Channel is the in the PREVENT program, you get referred to a panel where they question you, interrogate you about your beliefs, and if they find you have extremist beliefs, you will go on to some kind of reprogramming. Okay? And there, I have other examples, but I've only got 10 minutes, so I really don't want to go into them. We can go into them in Q&A if you like. This is the reality of what's happening today. This is not policy set by Senator Joe McCarthy. This is Theresa May, Michael Gove, and predecessors like Hazel Blears, and supported by the opposition. Unfortunately, there is a cross-party consensus on counter-extremism strategy in Britain at the moment. And nobody is really questioning it. And as Peter was saying to me earlier, when he showed me something he's written, some politicians frequently actually up the ante because electorally it's kind of popular if you say you're going to be tough on extremism. But if you don't believe me, this strategy is nothing to do with terrorism. Believe me, it is nothing to do with terrorism. It is everything to do with people's political views or their religious beliefs and values. And if you don't believe me, go and read what Sir Peter Fahey, the Chief Police Officer of Greater Manchester, who is in charge of PREVENT for the police force, wrote in The Guardian in December 2014 when he said, the police are in danger of becoming thought police. Those were his words, thought police. Why? Because nobody has given them a definition of what extremism is, so they've had to make up their own definition. And they've been making judgments like this, just as schools have been making judgments like this, just as Ofsted has been going into schools and making judgment about political views and religious values, just as school teachers are, and since the Counterterrorism and Security Act 2015, just as doctors, social workers, university lecturers, and even nursery nurses and nursery teachers will be expected to do. That is the reality of Britain's current counter-terrorism and security laws, counter-extremism strategy. I work, my day job is a GP, right? Every doctor will tell you the need to have trust with your patients is essential. The police will tell you the need to police with trust between them and their community is essential. Social workers can't function without trust. School teachers cannot function without trust. This policy, which is now on a statutory footing, meaning the professionals that I've just talked about are now, if they suspect terrorism, have got to report it and got to set into this process where people are referred to this panel called Channel. This policy is only in its early stages. So as it rolls out, you are going to see, effectively, school teachers and doctors and nurses and social workers doing the job of the police. And some recognise this. At two teaching union conferences this year, this policy was slammed by the teachers as expecting them to spy on children. As if that isn't bad enough, I can tell you this. When the whole country has a licence to talk about jihad and Sharia and what's happening in Syria, and what is an Islamic State and a caliphate? I can tell you now, in most Muslim communities around the countries, most imams wouldn't touch this subject matter with a barge pole for fear of being labelled an extremist or a preacher of hate. Well, they wouldn't touch it in any meaningful way. They might give a government narrative on it, okay? So they might say, oh, you know, jihad is just jihad of the soul, struggle against your old soul. Well, there is Islamic text that talks about that, but there's also Islamic text that talks about rules of engagement in warfare. And so because no imam will talk about that, there's this vacuum in the Muslim community at the moment, a vacuum which actually young people will go and get filled from wherever they like. Okay, so they'll go online, they'll go and look for answers. It isn't me. I don't think I've successfully radicalized anyone in my 20 years with this organization. People get agitated by what they see and hear on the news. I think BBC News 24 does more to agitate people than I ever could. Is that my time up?
No, I don't know when that gets wrong. Okay. You've got a couple of minutes.
I will end with this dilemma that I think this society faces. On the one hand, you have some, I don't say all, I say some amongst policymakers and opinion formers who are trying to prove that liberalism can be as supremacist as any other political or religious doctrine. For them, Sisi in Egypt is the good guy and the elected government is the bad guy. For them, when General Rahil Sharif of Pakistan comes to London on his only visit and it's mentioned in the press, the only agenda item is why don't you ban Hizbut Tahrir and some Baluchi opposition groups, he's the good guy. For them, prevent is Britain's blasphemy laws. An extremist is a secular word for heretic. And Channel is their modern inquisition. And Ofsted, the Charities Commission, doctors and teachers and lecturers are expected to be the arm of the police state. And I don't really think I'm exaggerating when I say that. And on the other hand, you have people like me, the blasphemer and the heretic, according to their standard, who has every intention of really trying to hold on to my values and my identity when I know they want to take it away. And I want to go out and tell Muslims around the country that they should do the same, even though they're under pressure to change their religion and change their values and beliefs because the dominant norms are the ones they are supposed to accept. And that is a dilemma that this society faces. I know, and I think anybody who's studied history or even studied religion would know who always comes out the winner in that struggle. When the state authorities who want to impose something on people have tried to do that, wherever it has been in the world, it doesn't usually work. Even when you get to the extent that Stalin went to try and suppress religion, Muslims built basements, and they used to teach their children the Quran in the basements of their houses because it's too important to them. And that's fundamentally why I think you've got this dilemma going on. Thank you.
Great, thank you. Thank you very much. That was 12 minutes. And we do have half an hour, which is great. I think we're going to move some microphones over to the table. I had no great confidence in that microphone, which looked to me to be very puny. Excellent. Yeah. Lack conviction as a microphone. So I'm glad to see a proper microphone. I will take a few questions, comments. I'm going to have to chair it fairly briskly, so you won't mind if I cut you off if you're a bit too long. And I'd really like to know whether you're LSE or not. It doesn't matter at all if you feel you can't do it, but it'd be good for us to locate you. And I'm going to go round the room and take two or three. If it's a specific question to an individual, then perhaps give that. Can we put the slide up at the back as well? Yeah. So we got that gentleman has caught my eye immediately. Is there anybody in this group that'd like to catch my eye? Over there, or take a bid. We've got two, we've got three. So just maybe in the next round, sir. One, two, three.
Hi, I work at LSE in the administration. I wondered whether you draw a distinction between free speech and free press or corporate speech.
Is that to Peter particularly or just
to everyone?
Okay. Thank you very much. Succinct. Might buy us time for a fourth question from you. Yeah.
Hi, I'm Kelly. This is directly for Peter. I just wanted to clarify in your statement, you were talking about how within every democracy there are undemocratic institutions. Is that what you... I wasn't sure. Including rule of law, House of Lords... So,
Don't get him started in the House of Lords. It might be that. Sir.
My name's Jamal Harwood. I'm a Muslim activist. I think, aren't we in danger of actually turning this whole free speech thing upside down? And what I say is that, you know, the Charlie Hebdo, horrific that it was, is really an indication of a freedom to insult and vilify, particularly religious matters, rather than what I think free speech should be about and it should be directed towards, which is really political accountability. We should be accounting our politicians and leaders and so on and so forth. And this is really where I'm so troubled by issues like Prevent, which seems to be clamping down on that. And again, if we look at the direction of travel, the more that we lead towards this freedom to vilify and insult and so on and so forth, can we not see maybe a change in our society and the fact that, you know, the relationship, the respect for teachers, for police, for parents is actually eroding in this particular type of society?
Okay, thanks, Jamal. It's sort of it's a kind of comment, isn't it? So we can let them respond to it as they wish. I was going to take a fourth because you've all been so disciplined, and then we'll go around the table. But we're going to get lots more rounds in, and already one guy's caught my eye, so do catch my eye. Sir.
Good afternoon. I'm a solicitor and a Muslim. To what extent does this comment reflect the intention of those that are drafting the laws and the desired result? War is peace, slavery is freedom, ignorance is strength. For those that don't know, that was what Orwell wrote in 1984, his much acclaimed novel. Thank you.
Powerful. And in the shape of a question or just a provocative? Yeah. Good. Bilal, do you want to start us off or do you want Peter to start us off?
I'm happy to deal with the question about free speech and a free press.
Yeah, you do that. Yeah. And you don't have to do them all, so you pick
sure.
that one.
It was your question, wasn't it? I think that in terms of the way that the European Convention on Human Rights looks at this, and indeed domestic law, because it's part of how the domestic legal structure to incorporate the convention principle. I mean, in some senses, the right to free expression is the right, but the press is preserved certain entitlements within that. And indeed, for example, there's a distinction between artistic, the way the court looks at the artistic expression and political expression. Political expression is a very, very, very protected form of expression. So if you make comments about politicians in particular, you're allowed a wide latitude, whereas artistic expression may be more limited. And I think what you were asking, so the press is particularly protected in terms of what it does, particularly if it's about politics. But in terms of corporate speech and corporate entities, it seems, to, as far as I'm aware, and Connor may be able to, or anybody else in the room might be able to help me, that isn't looked at as a particular category of expression. So in other words, the convention principles apply as I described them. The press has a special place, political expression has a special place, artistic expression allows a little bit more satire, etc. But there isn't a specific approach to corporate speech. The same kinds of principles attach and apply. Does that help?
Okay. Thanks, Abdul, and then Peter.
So I feel a bit out of my depth with this kind of class, but maybe I can educate you as to a different worldview on this. Actually, the Islamic view on speech is that there are certain types of speech which are obliged on Muslims to express. And that includes political accounting, right? So if that comes in the form of a press, or as an individual, or as a political organization, accounting power for politicians is not an option. It's something that we're all supposed to do. As opposed to wantonly insulting people, racist speech, slanderous speech, which religiously is prohibited. So actually, this distinction exists in my worldview very much.
Thank you. And finally in this round, Peter, and then I'm going to the floor, and I might even have a question myself for Dr. Wahid. Yeah.
Maybe I should have used the phrase a-democratic rather than democratic. What I was really saying is the system of law, for instance, is compatible with a tyranny in some ways. I mean, not entirely, but at any rate, it can exist within all sorts of political sort of structures, and is hereditary, you might call the hereditary peerage, which I'm such a supporter of, undemocratic. I think, does that help? Does that answer you a bit?
It's something that we don't elect.
Sorry? People, yeah, something which is not, and I think, as I say, democracy is very dangerous. I mean, in the sense that it's open to all kinds of perversions and strange movements and illiberal outcomes. And then I do think I think I was very attracted to the Orwellian question. It's very interesting because I've been brooding on this new language which has suddenly invaded our public discourse, extremist, radical, moderate. And so you can be the dictator, you can be the unelected king of a notorious Arab Gulf state, famous for torturing and sponsoring murderous movements such as Al-Qaeda. And you're a moderate because you're on the side of the Brits. Radical is radical, not an example. It's actually a virtuous word. You were a radical politician. It meant that you were a bit unconventional, you challenged the consensus, and you had fresh ideas. Now it's become, only for Muslims, mind you, only if you're a Muslim, it's become a very, very, very dangerous. And so I completely agree that a new language, an extremism, again, has been invented so that it purely applies. I mean, Sam David Cameron went to a Sikh temple the other day, couple of weeks ago. They were duly segregated, and Sam Cam wore a headscarf, I think, or something similar. But of course, that wasn't extremists, because it was in a Sikh temple. But had that taken place in a mosque, it would have been extremists. And so what you have here is the invention of a language which applies invidiously to one religion and not to others. And is being deliberately. Free speech. The other point about free speech is different to the free press. There are all kinds of different ways in which speech exists in academic institutions like this one, or in private discourse in the family home, in social media, etc. In novels, and each one of them has its own different set of rules.
Yeah, thanks. Brilliant. I've got three already. I've got you, I've got you, and I've got this gentleman. I'd like to say who you are. I know a couple of my students. And then I'm going to ask a question of Peter and a question of Abdul, and then we'll go back to the round. So, where you go?
Hi there. My name is Cameron. I'm one of Professor Gertie's students. It's actually a really good lead-off from what you just said, Peter. I'm curious why, when we're talking about extremism, it does always seem to center on Islamic extremists. We're not necessarily talking about, you know, Christian radicals or any other group. I'm wondering if you could speculate on why that is such a theme that seems to shine through when we're talking about extremism.
Right, and maybe the others might have a view on that as well. Have you got a microphone beside you?
Yeah.
Is there a microphone in your hand?
No.
Have you got a microphone in your hand?
Yeah.
Right, here it's coming very quickly.
I got a question for Dr. Abu Wahid.
And remind us all who you are.
Oh, my name is Chia from Professor Gertie's class. I'm interested in about this, your criticism against the prevent strategy. I noted that. But what about this extremism, about this influence to the younger generation to go to fight the war in the Middle East? Where do you draw the line between extreme and not extreme? For them, it is not extreme. But for the others, it's extreme. Where do you draw the line, and where can you categorize them as being extreme or not extreme? Thank you.
Thank you, Chia. Really good. And we might come to you first after the next round on that. There's a gentleman here. Have we only got one microphone today?
Yes. Yeah.
We're on a sort of austerity drive with microphones. If you want to borrow this minute one here, I'm sure it's no good. Sir.
Yeah, I'm Leroy Logan. I'm a retired police officer from the Met. And I was very interested. By the way, I'm going into a bit of academia to regain my thought processes from 30 years.
This as a representation of academia.
Yeah.
Some new scholarly illusion.
Yeah. And that's my steady hand as well. Anyway, One of the things that I'm amazed at is how political dictates have come through the police for so many years, in particular contest, and how it's actually influenced so many people, in particular the press. And I'm surprised it wasn't brought up by Leveson, because that showed for me a real, real concern about police in bed with the press and how it influences general media. And for me, the real concern is the racial profiling and faith profiling that it has on a day-to-day basis. Not just with Joe and Josephine Public, but also my ex-police colleagues who play this out on an operational and tactical basis day in, day out. And, of course, at the strategic level. So my question is, how do you turn this around? Because it's so widespread. And I don't always agree with Peter Fahey on a lot of things, because I've locked horns with him on quite a few things. But I think he's clearly hitting on an issue that needs to be built on in terms of the thought police and the new terrorism act, and, of course, how people will be demonised. And I will end by saying, Waheed, I respect you for the issues that you're raising, because if not, the whole contest brand will be so toxic that it's going to create more problems than solutions.
Thanks a lot. My question, we'll go to the panel. Peter, it's a rare thing to have somebody on the platform who's actually made quite a big sacrifice for free speech, the resignation from the paper, because of this way in which HSBC was sort of engaging with the editorial side and so on. But we know this is in the public domain, but you've not been hired by another newspaper. How prevalent, this is a question for you, and then I'll have one for Dr. Waheed. How prevalent do you think the practices are that you came across in the Telegraph? And are you now, you know, like the woman from the Foreign Office who resigned over the Gulf War, too hot to handle? And you're going to be sort of producing your own blog and so on and handing it out in pamphlets in Oxford Street. And, you know, I mean, making a joke about it, but it's an important point that you will have thought about. For you, I think we've got to come in with this, and I think we can't leave it on exam. Mm. Essentially, as Peter reminds us, free speech is never free, so we've already accepted that. The very first debate I ever did in England was at the Cambridge Union, and it was arguing to control the speech of fascists. So I was there saying control speech, control speech, control speech. Why am I saying that and not saying it to you? Now, you're obviously not a fascist, but is a democratic society allowed to take a view about the kind of things you would believe in and say, with the greatest possible respect, we're not going to let you say them. We don't let people say things that are overtly racist. We don't let people say things that are fascist. We have a democratic society which we're going to protect, and you can't protect it without having what Michael Ignatieff have called carnivores in the culture who'll do a bit of hard work to protect it. You know, it's an argument with which you're familiar. I'm putting it up there because it might be on people's minds, and they mightn't have had the chance or thought they wanted to say it. And now there's a bunch of questions. Some of them are combined, like mine is linked, I think, to yours, Joe. Do you want to start us off on this round, or do you want to?
Yeah, that's fine.
And then we go through your lady up to Pete.
So, the point, first of all, is the first thing that came to my mind when you said that is we have to be clear. There isn't a watertight legal definition of extremism in the way that you lawyers deal with other things. A friend of mine who's a lawyer tells me that if you steal something, well, there's a legal definition of what constitutes stealing for the police to be able to apply whether or not indeed you have broken the law. Okay? That there is no such definition of extremism. In the last year, the government has got a bit closer to saying that it's vaguely to do with undermining any fundamental British values, and it named a few. But even that's very loose. So you're talking about very political law that can be applied to whoever you want to apply it to and shelved when it comes to other people. Okay? Now, in the general principle of where should a society go, of course, every society is going to have those limits. And by and large, those limits are set in law, aren't they? Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah. And you know, people will say, you come from a belief that has no problem with curtailing lots of types of speech, and that's right. And it's there in the framework of the legal code that we believe in, and it's up front for everyone to see. It doesn't say that, yeah, say what you want, believe what you want, and then, you know, when you do that, we're going to criminalise it, sometimes in retrospect. Okay. Now, as I understand English law at the moment, there are, you know, incitement rules, whether it's racism, incitement to violence, and all these kind of things. I think, you know, those laws, if they were enforced rigorously, I'd have a very easy time. My organisation would have a very easy time, frankly. You know, because even when we talk about issues that are controversial, or even when we talk about issues like Muslims in Muslim countries that fight off Western forces that invade them, we don't actually believe, as an organisation, that people should go from here and fight. Okay. At the same time, we do not believe that somebody who's there fighting against an occupier is doing something that either constitutes terrorism. They're doing something which is called fighting an occupier. So I think, as it stands, English law has these limits, and it just doesn't choose to work these limits. It's chosen to blur the limits very broadly at the moment to apply to whoever it wants to. The guy who gave the Orwell quote, he said, war is peace, this and that. I've got a great quote in my bag, which I discovered years ago, and I've been aching for a chance to use it in the media. When I read it, British troops were in Iraq, and they were being killed by the Iraqis. And Iraqis who collaborated with British and American troops were being killed also. Okay? And the quote says, it is the primary right of men to fight, no, to kill and die for the land they live, and to overthrow the invader, and to punish with utmost severity those who warm their hands at the invader's hearth. Okay? Winston Churchill, the history of the English-speaking peoples. Churchill says that, and it's a bestseller. Abdul Wahid says that in a different context. And he's a radicalizer. Yeah.
And Churchill would say, as long as I kill them first, they won't be able to kill me. He took a military approach, I think. Eulalie, on our way across to Peter, yeah, comments, pick up anything you want.
I just wanted to pick up the point you raised about why extremism is used predominantly to describe the behavior of religious minorities, such as Muslims, rather than otherwise. I mean, and one of the things that drew my attention to was, of course, do you remember the guy, I've forgotten his name briefly now, the Norwegian man. I mean, no one focused on his Christianity. Indeed, no one focused on the sort of people who were involved in Columbine in the U.S., the white extremists. No one focused on the way in which their thinking was connected to certain forms of extremist religious beliefs. And that's why I think the answer to your question is, you don't have to speculate. It's clear that in some ways, the definitions of extremism that we now use and that are promulgated in certain kinds of quasi-legal texts, as Leroy points out, are responsive and reactive to things that happened around 9/11. And therefore, what it involves is a form of, is an impulse to define acceptability, in which certain kinds of people, some and many of them brown, many of them Muslim, fall outside of those parameters. That's in effect what it is. And it seems to me only recently we have seen right-wing extremism begin to creep into that lexicon. And indeed, that should always have been there if we're going to talk about extremism. And I just wanted to make one comment on the point that Leroy made about racial and faith profiling and the way in which it's infected the public discourse. And I think that, I think in one sense, firstly, it's obviously true. But I've noticed something quite interesting recently, which is that Theresa May and the powers that be have begun to sort of, as it were, like black people. Since we have a problem with extremism in the Muslim community, the poster boy is now a black man who has been racially profiled. So it's a very, very, very interesting development, it seems to me. So that it's a way of, in some senses, juxtaposing or creating or potentially creating divisions between different ethnic minority groups. Yeah, it might be. I'm going to go as far as that, but it's a bit of that. But those are my comments.
Very interesting. Excellent. Peter, yeah. And we'll get one or two more in. I know this chap's caught my eye, but you answer our question.
Yeah, I just to answer your question, which was how prevalent is the influence of advertising, editorial, commercial use by advertisers of their commercial clout. I'm not going to talk about the Daily Telegraph. I've done everything there, but it's Nick Davies of The Guardian wrote a brilliant book. If anybody interested in the press, really must read Nick Davies' brilliant book about the press. He published about 4 years ago, and he said it didn't happen. And that was a reflection of 30 years in journalism. He'd never seen it happen, advertisers affect editorial. I do think that the environment has changed very significantly in the last 5 years or so, owing to the rise of the internet and the collapse of circulations, and the advertisers aren't paying. Papers are just fighting for survival. This is a general point. And social media is creating a new commercial world. The whole financial framework which underpinned the press and the media, including, has vanished. BuzzFeed, which is a new media operation, has had two notorious cases recently where copy was actually taken down from being online. I think I'm right in saying they deny it was because of advertisers. But so in other words, it's something we need now to start being aware of in a way we weren't before. I do want to have a go briefly at answering. You asked us to speculate on why it is the word extremist is used specifically to describe Muslims. I don't really like speculating because I don't think it helps very much or attributing motive. It's always best to just observe what is said and done. But it is the case, I think, that this new word, this new use of the word extremism in this, the thing is put into two ways. One is that extremism is really not a word that describes something, it's a word which does something. It's an attack word. It's always used in politics. I feel this is some bitterness. I was one of the group of people who opposed entry to the euro 15 years ago. And we were denounced always for very big as extremists. I did a study of it in a little book called Guilty Men about how the left wing, the Guardian, the Mirror, and the pro-Europeans, we were all extremists, sort of dribbling at the mouth and demented and frenzied. That was another word. We were clearly unhinged. The key phrase was we were extremists. And it was a political attack word invented actually by, used particularly by New Labour. They tried to claim the centre, and anybody who didn't belong to this blessed position in the centre, who were moderates, were extremists. And it's now been reheated up as an attack word aimed at Muslims. But it's also, I think this is a very important thing to understand, it's part of an intellectual system. This is why it doesn't really fit in with describing right-wing extremists and so forth, right-wing killers, I mean. Because there is a system which lies behind prevent, an intellectual analysis that you move from being a moderate to being an extremist, and then you move to killing people. And that's why you have to stop people being extremists, because extremists create this pool of people who have deranged beliefs, they do terrible things, they pray 5 times a day in some cases, it's known to have happened. And and Hazel Blair said, you pray 5 times a day, I'm paraphrasing, that makes you a dangerous person because you're clearly somebody who, and this is a doctrine, an ideology, that people who take their religion seriously, then Muslim, are somehow dangerous. And they move along an escalator. And you can actually trace how this set of ideas was developed. It forms the basis of prevent. And extremist is therefore, it is a word which is out there to do something rather than describe something in what you might call a rational. And that's why it's difficult, it isn't used to others.
Peter?
Yeah.
Peter, can I stop you there? Because I want to get two more in.
Yeah.
And then we really have to finish. Because wearing my teacher's hat, I'm getting impatient at the fact that I've not drawn this meeting to a close. We have a microphone going over there. Peter, do you want to stick your hand up and say who you are? And we have a microphone for you. Now, you're going to need to be, was you, wasn't it? Pretty brisk, Peter.
Okay.
And if focused on one person will be helpful.
That's tricky because Peter Ramsey from the Law Department is LSE.
Oh, if it's tricky, carry on.
I want to take up just the idea that the extremism is only a category that applies to Muslims, because it doesn't seem to me that's right. It may be that the word is only used in relation to Muslims, but extremists are being found everywhere, and they do have something in common. So in Scotland, it's a criminal offence to sing traditional Republican or Protestant loyalist songs, and lots of people are being convicted of that offence for simply singing songs that relate to long-standing intolerant traditions in Scotland of you know, hatred of the other side. Breivik, I think, was described as an extremist at the time. The only reason that wasn't taken up was the sensible approach of the Norwegian authorities to dealing with him, so it didn't get any traction. At the LSE itself, and this is on the prevent strategy, the LSE itself, there was a row, which most people who here will remember, about the rugby club pamphlet. It seems to me if you read the LSE's official response to what to do about the problem of sexism and homophobia that allegedly exists here, you will see precisely the prevent strategy. We need to identify those people who are at risk of having the wrong attitude, bring them before workshops to deal with that attitude, and indeed, what lies behind that is the view that people who have that attitude are a danger of committing sexual assault. That's exactly the underlying view. So it's not restricted, I think, to Muslims, although the word extremist maybe. The underlying logic has a much wider traction in liberal society. I'd be interested to know what they think.
Very interesting. It's a pity we have to end soonish. And the very last thing is going to be you, and then I'm going to go to the panel, and then you're out. So it needs to
Thank
be
you.
Fantastically short, and you need to tell
I'll
us
try.
Who you are.
So I'm also an LSE student, and this was after your comment, Ms. Burnham, on Anders Behring Breivik, because after his internet activities, you now require full name, I think email, at least that you identify yourself if you want to comment on news, comments online. And my question is really if you have a reaction to that, is anonymity sort of, well, how important is anonymity of all in this, and is it good that you have to do this now?
Great.
And identify yourself.
Thank you, NSC student. Why not? And then Peter, very quickly,
just
and last
to respond to the point you raised over there, I didn't actually say that extremism is only used in relation to Muslims. What I'm saying is the genesis of this term and the way it creeps into political discourse and indeed legal discourse comes from a response to 9/11. That's what I was basically saying. I think the problem is it's too loose a term and it tends to disadvantage particular groups. That was my point. And there are dangers with the strategy, because it seems to me you get immediately a sort of inside-outside grouping. And the inside grouping, it tends to be mainstream. And that's the problem. So I'm not making a more extravagant or indeed blinkered, blinded point. So it seems to me, in relation, if you could you just repeat the question?
Or take it up at the end, because
yeah.
I think we're not going to have the time, yeah. To be honest with you.
Okay.
Can we have a chat on the way out? Because we're going to run out of time. People have things to do at 2:30, and I do want to hear. Peter, is that all right for you?
Yeah,
you have a minute, won't you? Peter, as quickly as you can before we go to talk about it.
It's very, very briefly. I think that we do need to analyse. We need, in the press, I think what we do need is a new lexicon, a new style guide, really, to a whole load of words which have infiltrated themselves into mainstream political discourse, Islamist, extremist, moderate, radical. It's time we had a style guide. A very much final point. It's like one day I read about a Muslim extremist who goes to the mosque 2 times a day. And the same paper might have on the front page an extremist as murders X people in a suicide bomb. It's very, very ugly the way these two words are used.
Yeah, very good. And I think this will be the last contribution.
Okay, so this issue of extremism, yeah, sure, it is used for other people. But in the current political context, right-wing extremism was introduced relatively recently as a term, because it looked pretty obviously that you're just targeting the Muslim community. And alongside that, the degrees of extremism. You have the right-wing extremism, Breivik, who basically went to a youth camp and machine-gunned a whole bunch of young people. And you have Muslim extremists described like this by Tower Hamlets in their official guidance to parents after the young girls going off to Syria. As part of some forms of radicalization, parents may feel their child's behavior seem to be improving. Children may become quieter and more serious about their studies, right? So there's a kind of disproportionate kind of extremism. And the third thing, that's true, that's real. I can give you the web link for that. I know we're laughing, and that's great, but when you go away and you think about it, and you think that some kid in Tower Hamlets is going to have this applied to that's the same with all this stuff. On one level, it is just so ridiculous, it's laughable. And the final thing is the difference between the other forms of extremism and Islamic extremism. And this comes to your point, sir. With Islamic extremism, there's a conveyor belt, okay? So you start off as the one who prays five times a day, right? And then you're the one who really takes more religious observation more seriously. You wear a scarf, you cover your face, you don't want to play a musical instrument, you want to sit, you organise a gathering and men and women sit separately, and then somewhere along the line you join Hizb ut-Tahrir, and then somewhere along the line it's Al-Qaeda, and now there's ISIS and God knows what they'll be tomorrow. Yeah? And so the official policy is we make a criminal division at a certain point, and currently it's between political Islamists and violent people, okay? But that may shift. And the other official policy is, if becoming more Islamic makes you more of a risk, let's do things that make people less Islamic. Let's promote people that reform the religion. Let's demonize mosques that teach a traditional form of the religion. And that's why you hear a lot of calls for Islamic reform being promoted by those sections of the political class.
Right. I can't say anything about that. Those three summaries were fantastic. It's been really amazing. 1 hour and 20 minutes, 1 hour and 15, we started a bit late, of intense discussion which covered exactly the range of things I had hoped it would cover. Thanks to all of you for coming and staying. As you leave, you will find a little postcard which I'd like you to be given. It plugs something called the Research Festival here at LSE. It's run by a half of my hat, the Institute of Public Affairs. It's open and we'd love you to come. It's got no connection whatsoever with this event. This event was launched by and run by LSE Law. Let me just say a couple of things as I end. One, thank you to LSE Law for not thinking twice about this. Well done, LSE Law. Big thanks to LSE Security, who have from the start taken the view that there was no question other than this should go ahead. There is a degree of nervousness around these issues in LSE. LSE has been the subject of attacks on the basis of misjudgments in the past. I want to just acknowledge publicly the 100% support we've had here in setting up this event, and it has repaid the school in spades with a superb set of presentations. Can we just, as you leave, applaud Ulele Burnham, Peter Oburn, and Abdul Wahid? Thank you very much. Thank you.